Well, hey, good morning. My name is Dwight. We don't have two Dwights on staff. This Dwight got a haircut. So if you're wondering where did all your hair go, I donated it to the floor of a barber shop. Doing quite well. So glad to be with you. Something happens magical in this weekend. Half the church just disappears, and it's amazing. But the better half of the church is here. So thank you for being here this morning. That was a joke. If you think that we have favoritism, we don't. But so glad that you are here. Happy Canada Day. And if you're new to Church 21, we would love to talk to you afterwards. If you're not yet a follower of Jesus, I'm so glad that you're here. We're going to get into the book of Job. There's a lot of complicated stuff in there, but hopefully we'll be able to explain it well. And we're going to work through 24 chapters today. You know, I was thinking, what can I give as a gift to the church on Canada Day? And I thought 24 chapters would be appropriate. So we're going to make it from Job chapter 4 all the way till Job chapter 27. So let me pray, and then we will do that. Jesus, thank you that you are here in this place. Thank you that you love us. Thank you that you're with us. Thank you that this time where we celebrate a nation, help us think about your kingdom, a better kingdom that's coming, one far better than Canada can ever be. Thank you for all the privileges and benefits we get of being citizens here in this nation, or immigrants to this nation, or refugees in this nation. And I pray that you would bless Canada. I pray that you would bless North America. I pray that you would take Montreal and make it a sending place around the world with the gospel, that we would be a people who are so caught up with who you are, Jesus, that we would long to give our lives away to those who don't yet know you. And we need you for this morning. We love you. Amen. All right, so a question to start it off today. What do Sam and Frodo, I was thinking multiple generations on this, but I'm downtown, maybe I didn't need to. What do Sam and Frodo, Woody and Buzz, Lucille and Ethel, that one probably goes over everyone's head here, but and Maverick and Goose, what do those pairings all have in common? This is where you can respond and say something. Best friends, okay? Anyone else? They work together. Okay, they're both wrong. They're fake. They're not real people. They're played by actors, okay? I'm just joking. You are both right, okay? They're friends, but they are fake. If you thought that Top Gun was real, it's not. Okay, did you have a friend group as a kid? This might bring up issues for some of you. You're like, no, why do you have to bring it up on Canada Day? My friend group was very special. We didn't really have a name, but thinking back, we could have called ourselves the Blood Brothers because every time the seven of us hung out, there was blood. We laughed together, we played together, but every single time there was a fight that broke out. I remember catching a football, walking backwards, having scored a touchdown, and my friend Morgan looked at me and just punched me. And I'm like, why would you do that? He's like, I don't know, you were there. I'm like, but I scored. You know, I did a good job. You get punished for doing good jobs, our friends. But here's the thing. No one could mess with any one of the seven of us. It was all seven of us together. We would protect one another. Who are your friends now? If you had that friend group as a kid, who are your friends now? Have you ever made a covenant with your friends? Some of the covenants in the Bible are made really awkwardly, like put your hand under my thigh. It's like, I don't have those covenant friends. But have you ever made a covenant with your friend? And this means a promise, a commitment that I'm going to be there for you. You're going to be there for me. We're not going to be fair weather friends. We're not going to be there just in good times, but we're going to be there for one another all the time. And maybe you've even written something down. There was a men's trip that we went away on, I don't know, it was months and months ago. It involved the hike. And we talked about friendship and covenant friendship. And I remember being there with my buddy and saying, man, we need to make a covenant with one another. We need to actually make this serious that we're not just going to hang out around the hobbies that we enjoy together, but that we're actually going to be there for one another all the time. It's less common in our day to have covenant friends, but it was very common in Bible times. This meant, if you made a covenant to someone, this meant that you were committed to them, thick or thin. You had an intimate counselor, someone that would give you good counsel. You had a loyal love of a friend. We become uncomfortable with some of this language, but this is what true friendship was. And it was someone that would care for you in all times. Now, it's going to be really important that we take that view of friendship Not our view, modern 21st century, like Facebook friends or follower, not that type of friendship, but biblical friendship as we look at chapters 4 to 27. All right? So let me just recap really, really quick of where we've gone in the past few weeks. There's this guy named Job. He was an upright man. He was blameless, not perfect, but blameless. And we get let into the heavenly realms, and we see a conversation between God and Satan. If you're like, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in Satan, well, just imagine with us for a minute. I believe that both of them are real beings, but imagine that this was true. Imagine if all of this morning were true, and if it is true, what would that do for your life? But let me go back to that scene where God is speaking with Satan, and Satan has been going to and fro all throughout the earth. Satan is not omnipresent. He can't be everywhere at one time. He's located in one place at one time. And God says, hey, have you considered my servant Job? Blameless, upright. And Satan says, the only reason why Job really loves you is because you haven't brought anything hard on him. And so he allows for Satan to touch his life. And Job lost so much. He lost his kids, 10 kids dead. He lost his property, he lost his vocation, he lost his health, and he lost his dignity. And it had been months of suffering. Brian Stegner last week was here preaching, right? It was Brian? Yeah. Okay, goldfish brain for a second, right? But he went through that Job had these boils on his skin, and boils are really nasty, and Brian went into great detail in the West Island explaining that. I don't know if you were blessed with that here. But basically, Job is sitting with broken pieces of pottery, scraping these boils off to bring himself comfort. It's a nasty picture. And he's been doing this for months. So I'm going to allude to some texts, and I'm also going to read some texts, okay? So I'm just going to mention some, and I'm going to go into detail with some. But in Job chapter 7, verse 3 to 5, Job says, it's been months that I have been suffering. But there's good news, right? If you're suffering and you're extroverted or you're introverted, maybe you would want Uber Eats to come or something. But if you're suffering, you want someone to come and console you. You want someone to pay attention. You want someone to come and comfort you. And the good news is that after months of suffering, Job's friends do come. In Job chapter 2, verse 11, it says, now when Job's three friends heard all the evil that had come upon him, they each came from his own place. Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, and Zophar, the Naamathite, and they made an appointment together to come and show him sympathy and comfort him. So they come to show sympathy and comfort, or comfort and console, and both of these have the image of what a parent, but most likely a mom, would do to a child, where you would rock someone gently. They came with that intention. What we're going to get into is a pretty intense conversation between Job and his friends. So I keep laying out the groundwork to make sure we know that their intentions were really good, that they loved him, that they were committed to him, and he was committed to them. But when they see him, look at what happens. Verse 12 of Job chapter 2. When they saw him from a distance, they didn't recognize him. They raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. Have you ever walked in on suffering that was so intense you just didn't know what to say? Have you ever walked in on suffering that was so intense you didn't know what to say for a week? This is what his friends are seeing. They're entering into his grief, and they're just quiet for an entire 7 days. And then Job in chapter 3, which Brian went through a little bit last week, he laments his situation, decrying the fact that he was even born. And then the conversation begins. And there's three different series of conversations between the three friends and Job back and forth. I'm not going to get into all of that unless you want to hang out all day together, which I'm pretty sure most of you don't want to. But we're going to start in chapter 4, where Eliphaz starts by saying, hey, in verse 2, can I speak? Is it okay if I speak? And then here's his words in chapter 4, verse 7 to 9. Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity, that's another word for sin, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God, they perish. And by the blast of his anger, they are consumed. This is a very poetic way of saying, Job, this is all your fault. Isn't that special? Aren't you hoping for those type of friends? In your moment of greatest needs, they come along and say, this is all because of you. What they were doing, what he was doing, and what the friends are going to do all throughout these conversations is they're going to present the retributive principle. It's a fun word early in the morning. Retributive principle. And basically what that means is that God preserves the innocent and destroys the wicked. God preserves the innocent, destroys the wicked. Now you might be here thinking, that sounds true. And it's half true. Because the way that they're presenting it is that God always, in every circumstance and situation, preserves the innocent. It's going to be an interesting morning. Can't pronounce words already. Preserves the innocent and destroys the wicked all the time. They're bringing a damning reality to their friend. That's not right. This is like the religion of Santa Claus. It's not my place to tell you whether he's real or not, okay? But the religion of Santa Claus goes like this. It's in a helpful song. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. And he knows if you've been bad or good. So be good for goodness sake. That's how we should sing the song, not all happy and cheerful. But this is Santa Claus' religion. That he's going to give you good, but only if you've been a good boy or girl. And if you haven't been a good boy or girl, you're going to get coal or nothing or whatever. They're presenting this religion of Santa, and here's the thing. This belief in the retributive principle was so prevalent in the ancient Near East throughout the generations that Jesus actually had to correct it with his disciples. In John chapter 9, verse 2 and 3, there's a man who was born blind, and his disciples come to him and they say, Jesus, was it this man or his parents that were in sin? Who brought the blindness onto him? And Jesus said, no, it wasn't either one of them. The retributive principle is not true. It's very karma-like, and that's not how God works. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But if we follow the course of logic that this retributive principle is bringing, then it makes sense when Eliphaz says in chapter 5, verse 4, the death of your kids, all 10 of your kids, your fault. How comforting would that be? If you lost your children and your buddy comes and says, all that, your fault. Not super comforting, not helpful. But then he gets all spiritual. He says, even though it's your fault, why don't you just go to God? Why don't you just have a conversation with God? In chapter 5, verse 8, he says, as for me, if I were you, basically, as for me, I would seek God. And to God would I commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. It's simple, Job. Stop your whining, stop your boil scraping, stop your belly aching, and go to God. And then he adds on this beauty in chapter 5, verse 17. Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves. Therefore, despise not the discipline of the Almighty. He says, be happy you're getting disciplined like this. Be happy that you're suffering in this way, because God is disciplining you. Now, this friend, Eliphaz, is making huge assumptions. He's saying things that he doesn't fully know. He didn't know the behind-the-scenes conversation between God and Satan. He didn't know what was going on before he arrived in the months of suffering. He didn't know if Job was having conversations with God or not. He didn't know. He just jumped out of the silence and jumped all over his friend with a, it's your fault. All of this is on you. You're the problem. It's you. Huge assumptions made. Have you ever entered into a conversation with your friend making huge assumptions? Probably all of you would say yes. Yes, we have, Dwight. Because we all do this. We all assume certain things are taking place in a certain way, shape, or form. And so the wisdom that we pick up along the way, because that's what we're going to do, we're going to pick up wisdom along the way. The wisdom we get out of this is rather than showing up to our suffering friend with assumptions in mind, we stop and we ask questions of what's been happening. You see, friends are to provide presence and compassion, not fixating on searching out the source of the suffering. Does that make sense? Friends are for presence and compassion, not asking questions so we can search out why are you suffering in the first place? It's to be with them. The source might reveal itself later, but it's to be with them in what they're actually going through. And so Job answers for the first time in Job chapter 6, verse 8 to 10. Job says this, "Oh, that I might have my request, and that God would fulfill my hope, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. That would be my comfort. I would even exult in pain unsparing, for I have not denied the words of the Holy One." If your friend is saying, "Listen, guys, I just want to die. I wish God would just cut me off." Maybe it's not your opportunity to keep pressing in this reality that it's your fault. He says to them in chapter 6, verse 14 to 21, "You're not refreshing. You're not refreshing at all. You're not helping me." And then he goes in chapter 6, verse 24 and 25 and says, "Teach me and I'll be silent. Make me understand how I have gone astray." Again, this isn't Job saying I'm perfect. It's him saying, "I don't see what I've done wrong to earn this. If that's what you're saying is true, if the retributive principle is true, I don't know what I've done wrong to earn this." So he basically says, "Prove to me, prove what I've done." So they do. They do. Maybe also wisdom isn't saying to your friends, "Prove it," when you see that they're upset. And so Bildad starts in chapter 8, verse 2, and he says, "How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind?" Modern-day terminology would be a windbag. "Job, you're a windbag. You're just speaking nonsense, Job." And so then Bildad says, "Let me give you some more religion," in chapter 8, verse 5. "If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great." He presents this prosperity understanding of God. That if you just say and do the right things, God will prosper you. In essence, he's presenting God like a lottery ticket to be won. If you just get the right numbers, then God is forced. You've kind of put him in an arm bar. That takes me to the whole Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, UFC match. Is that thing real or not? I don't know. But anyway, if one of them gets put in an arm bar, they're going to tap out. And in essence, Bildad is saying, if you get God in the arm bar, he's forced to prosper you. He's forced to give you what you want. And that's a lie too. And unfortunately, the prosperity gospel is being preached all over the world, most often in poor nations, by men, often men, some women, all dressed up, rolling in really, really nice cars, preaching to an extremely financially poor congregation, saying, if you just give us more money, gold dust is going to fall. Or if you just give us more money, then you can name and claim your health or your wealth, but it's going to cost you your money. You give, and then God will give back, because God's like a lottery ticket. And that's not true. That's a false gospel. That's a false understanding of who Jesus is. That removes the whole aspect of grace that God gives to those who are unworthy. And Bildad is spouting this ancient Near East prosperity theology. And Job goes on to say in Job chapter 10, in response to this, chapter 10, verse 2, he says, "I will say to God, don't condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me." In essence, he says, "I'm innocent. I'm innocent. I know I'm not perfect, but I'm innocent." We can't assume that when someone is suffering, it's because of their sin personally, that it's this strange cause and effect thing. The reality is we live in a very broken world. We live in a world where things don't go right. It seems like Murphy's Law wins all the time, right? Things don't go how you intend that they're going to go. It's broken. And we brought that into creation when we decided that we had a better plan than God did. Right? It's like taking something that we receive, reading the owner's manual, which was written by the person who made it, being like, "Well, this is garbage," throwing it out and doing whatever you want with it. right? Taking that blender, I used this analogy a long time ago, but taking that blender, plugging it in and being like, I think it's going to be a wonderful experience to sit in a bathtub and make a smoothie. Forget what the owner's manual says. We'll get rid of that. We live in that type of world. That's the brokenness that we encounter all the time. Things don't work. We go astray. We do things wrong. But Jesus suffered and didn't sin. So this gets rid of that point that suffering is a result of personal sin, because Jesus went through great suffering but never sinned. And we'll see that in a little bit. So let's keep going in the conversation. It's a neat conversation, isn't it? Don't you wish you were in Job's situation at this point? Job chapter 11, verse 5 and 6. Third friend, Zophar, comes in and says this: "But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom, for he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves." He looks at his friend and says, "You deserve more than you're getting. I know it's bad, Job, but you actually deserve more than you're getting." And here's the thing about this. That's actually true. That's actually true. It's just not true in this circumstance. And not only is it not true in this circumstance, but it's unhelpful that all of us deserve way more than we're getting, meaning deserving bad things. But God is a God of mercy and grace. He works out of not giving us the bad things that we deserve and giving us the good things that we don't deserve. He's not a God who works from the principle of karma, waiting to see what we do so that he knows how he's going to act. Rather, he's a God who delights to give mercy and grace to us all the time. You can't outrun the mercy of God. You can't outrun the grace of God. You can't outbad the mercy and grace of God. When you show up and you're like, "God, I am worse than you know," he's like, "I know that. I know that you're actually worse than you know it. And I love you. And I have mercy for you. And I have grace for you. Come back." So Job answers in Job chapter 13, verse 2 to 5. "What you know," he's getting a little frisky now. "What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you, but I would speak to the Almighty God, and I desire to argue my case with God. As for you, you whitewash with lies. Worthless physicians are you all. Oh, that you would keep silent, and it would be your wisdom." The Message version summarizes this by saying, "Shut up. You graffiti my life with lies. You're tagging lies all over my life." And so then God turns away from his friends for a minute and just turns to God in front of them. And he says this in chapter 13, verse 23 and 24. "How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin." He's saying, if I've done something wrong, God, I want to know about it. Please let me in on the secret. And he says, "Why do you hide your face and count me as your enemy? Why are you like an enemy to me?" Have you ever felt like God was really distant? Have you ever felt like God might be your enemy? Have you ever felt like God is doing things against you? Well, Job feels you. Job understands there's words in the Bible for you. Sometimes we say, "I don't know if I dare to say these things out loud." God's written these things down for you to be able to read back to him. The Psalms, there's 150 Psalms. You can sing them, you can say them, you can recite them, you can do whatever you want with them. But there are words there, really happy words, really sad words, really confused words, really angry words, words that end in hope, words that we're not sure how this is going to end. God gives that to you to be able to learn how to speak well to him and openly. He wants you to share about your frustrations. And then Job goes on to say that he wants reconciliation and he wants resurrection. He wants a whole new beginning. Listen to chapter 14, verse 13 to 17. "Oh, that you would hide me," speaking to God. "Oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, that you would conceal me until your wrath be past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my service, I would wait till my renewal should come. You would call and I would answer you. You would long for the work of your hands, for then you would number my steps. You would not keep watch over my sin. My transgression would be sealed up in a bag, and you would cover over my iniquity. If we got into all that, in essence, Job is saying, I want reconciliation with God, and I want resurrection. I want to see him with new flesh, new body. That's the hope that Job is longing for, that this boil-laden body, loss of all of his kids, losing everything, he wants a resurrection. If you're suffering, Jesus understands your suffering, and Job understands your suffering. In fact, Jesus walked upon the suffering of his friends, Mary and Martha, who had just lost their friend Lazarus. The story is in, or the account rather, is in John chapter 11, which is a book in the New Testament. We're not going to get into that all this morning. But as Jesus shows up and finds out that Lazarus has died, Mary and Martha say, if you would have been here, Jesus, he wouldn't have died. Why would they say that? Well, Jesus had been healing people of all kinds of wild diseases. Jesus had even raised people from the dead, and he shows up, and they're in mourning, and they're suffering. Now, Jesus actually raises Lazarus from the dead, but before he does that, rather than saying, Mary and Martha, get over it. You know I'm going to do something special for you. Instead of saying that, he enters into their pain first. He weeps alongside them. He feels, it says literally, in his bowels, so in his gut. He feels the pain that they're going through, and he weeps. He sees that this curse that has entered into the world is taking his friends. Despite the fact that he's going to do something, he's experiencing this with them. And then he looks at them and says, hey, I'm the resurrection. I'm the resurrection and the life. And they say, yeah, no, we understand in the final days, like, everyone's going to rise from the dead. No, I am the resurrection. It's all because of me. And then Jesus says, hey, remove the stone. And they're like, Jesus, you're not that wise, apparently. You didn't take biology because he's been in there 4 days and his body's going to stink at this point. He's like, move it. Let's go. They remove the stone and Jesus says, Lazarus, come out. And Lazarus comes out of the tomb. He wasn't laying in there. Jesus didn't say like, hey, just go in there, lay there. 4 days later, I'll call you out. We'll pull this whole thing. It'll be amazing. They knew what death meant. And Jesus says, Lazarus, come out. And some commentators say Jesus had to say Lazarus because if Jesus would have just said, come out, everyone would have gotten up out of their graves in that moment. That's the power that Jesus has, right? That's the power that is working with us. And so if you're hurting, you need to know this, that God knows that you hurt, and he hurts with you. He's not aloof. He's not in some cosmic corner of the galaxy waiting for you to just get over it. Stop being such a drama queen. Jesus enters into your suffering with you. He's in the pain with you, and he wants to remind you that all of this is leading toward resurrection. All of this is leading to every sad thing coming untrue. Can you imagine that? Every sad thing coming untrue. Not just swept under the rug to be found later. Coming untrue. This is a trajectory Jesus is taking us to. This is the hope that Job is looking forward to without fully knowing all the details yet. So let's get back into this conversation. We're almost done. You probably thought, I've heard you preach before, Dwight, 24 chapters, one day, no way. We're almost done. This was not easy to prepare for, by the way, but we're almost done. Eliphaz, good old Eliphaz, comes back, and he says in chapter 15, verse 3 to 6, basically, sin is leading you, Job. You're not being led by God. Sin is leading you. And Job looks at him, I imagine, with tired eyes, and he says, I'm broken, man. I'm broken. Job 17, verse 1, my spirit is broken. My days are extinct. The graveyard is ready for me. I'm as good as dead. Why are you still talking to me about this stuff? He says to them in chapter 16, verse 2 and 3, you're bad comforters. But the reality is that Job is still praying, and we'll look at that in just a minute. So Bildad, he gets offended after hearing Job. You ever had those friends that they come to you in your suffering, and you're just kind of saying stuff, and then they get offended? Wait, what do you mean by that? Like, I don't know what I mean by that. I just kind of said it. Oh, you think that's true? Like, I don't know if I think that's true or not. Like, I'm hurting. Like, I'm just saying stuff. But Bildad takes great offense to what Job is saying. And he says to Job, shut up. There's a shut up match going on, right? Job 18, verse 2 to 4. How long will you hunt for words? Consider, and then we will speak. Why are we counted as cattle? Why are we stupid, Job, in your sight? You who tear yourself in your anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or the rock be removed out of its place? Then he goes on to say in verse 21 of chapter 18, you don't even know God. Why are you speaking to us about God? You don't even know God. They went from starting about who God is to you don't even know him. You don't even know him. Here's the thing you need to understand. If this is a counseling principle, and I think all of us as followers of Jesus should be counselors to one another, right? The Spirit of God lives in all of us if we're followers. He is a great counselor. He gives us wisdom to be able to counsel. You have to know that if you're going to engage with hurt people, right? That's a phrase. Hurt people. They just do because they're hurting and they're trying to figure it out. And often they put that blame or weight on someone else. And if you're going to be a friend, you're probably going to get hurt in the midst of their pain. But the thing is, you're there. And you being there is not about you. It's not for you to earn some weird, you know, theological point or something for being there for your friend. It's you're not there for you. You're there for them. You have to keep reminding yourself that I'm not here for me. This is for them. And you can say things to them like, it's okay. It's okay. You can't say something that's going to get rid of me in this moment. I know you're hurting. I know things come out sideways. I know things strange. I know you're probably even feeling guilt. You can't get rid of me. I'm here for you. Unless you physically like push me out with a sword, I'm here. And Job says in Job 19, verse 21 and 22, he says, have mercy on me, guys. Have mercy on me. Oh, you, my friends. That's interesting, isn't it? They've been going at it with him, like punch after punch after punch, and he still says, oh, my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh? He says, have mercy on me, guys. Have mercy on me, please. I'm not doing this to myself. God is in charge, and it seems like all of you are against me. He says in Job 19, verse 19, all my intimate friends abhor me. Can't stand me or disgusted with me. And those whom I loved have turned against me. And so after hearing that, they all bring their final words to the table. Zophar says in Job chapter 20, verse 27 to 29, it's clear that your sin has been exposed. He's still looking at Job as, you're the problem. It's on you, your sin. Eliphaz attacks supposed sin list in chapter 22, verse 5 to 11. Some commentators think that he's just making this stuff up to justify himself and what he's been saying the whole time. When you have to make up things, when you're trying to address the hurt situation of your friends, probably you have issues. And then Bildad is the final one we'll look at in chapter 25, verse 5 and 6. He says this, behold, even the moon is not bright, and the stars are not pure in his eyes. How much less man who is a maggot, and the son of man who is a worm? Job, I love you, brother, but you're just a maggot. You're just a maggot. So glad we could be here for you. Here's the thing. We need to go back to that initial understanding of biblical friendship. That these friends, as they came, I believe that they meant well. I think they were there to actually comfort and console them, because that's what the Bible tells us that they were there to do. But their words were condemning. They were adding a further attack onto the attack that had already been on Job's life. And they were adding suffering from lies that they were speaking. They weren't there bringing truth. And here's the thing about Job, and this is a surprising piece of all of this conversation for me, that I've read Job so many times before, and this is the part that I never saw. Is that Job doesn't let his friends assume opinions and half-right theology inform his view. In fact, in the midst of Job's suffering, Job is ministering to his friends what's actually true about God. Job's friends were meant to come and minister to him, but Job instead is ministering to his friends what is true and right about God. Listen to what Job says in Job 23, verse 10. He says, he knows the way that I take, and when he has tried me, I shall come out as gold. I'm going to come out of this better, stronger, because I know that God is the one at work. And he says to them in chapter 26, verse 2 to 4, you're just unhelpful, guys. And in chapter 27, 5 and 6, you're not even right. But what's important to note, and what Job did a good job, and we don't see it all here in this text, is he's taking captive the lies that are being spoken to him. Sometimes people are going to come in with good advice in times of hurting, and it's not going to be good news. And you're going to have to take those ideas or lies captive and put them to death. Don't assume that what everyone is saying is good, right, and true all the time. Right? If you hear something and it's like, wow, it sounds half true, go to Scripture. Go to pastors. Go to other leaders. Go to friends. Say, this person told me this thing. Is this thing actually true? Because it's those lies, if we begin believing them, we build that on top of our suffering and we become extremely callous, and the healing process takes that much longer because all these lies that we've built up as layers around our hearts. So we need friends, and if our friends can't do it, we need ourselves to speak truth into our lives in these moments of suffering. And Job says this, my Redeemer lives. My Redeemer lives, so I have hope. My Redeemer lives, so I have hope. And this statement has massive implications, because if Job's Redeemer being God, if he's actually a living God, this living God puts everything into perspective. He puts everything into perspective. And so rather than cut off his friends because he has a living Redeemer who's with him, he can minister to his friends in that moment. We're so quick to cut off our friends, aren't we? We're so quick to say, you crossed the line. And I'm not saying you can't have boundaries with people. Some people are really toxic. Some people actually want to manipulate you for their ends. Some people are not out for your benefit. But most people aren't. Most people aren't. And so rather than just ending friendships and saying, I'm cutting you off, I'm unfollowing you, I'm blocking you, we lean into those and we say, hey, that hurt when you said that thing. In fact, I don't even think that that's true. Let's process through that together. Because at the end, Job's made a covenant with these friends, and their words didn't break the covenant that Job made with them. Job just keeps sharing throughout this text that we can't get into all of it, how amazing God really is. Like, guys, you're looking at my sin or my suffering or my whatever, but have you looked at God? Have you looked at my Redeemer who's alive, who's going to call me out of this suffering to see him face to face with new flesh? Have you seen him? He's not the retributive principle. He's a God of grace and a God of mercy. And the book of Job actually ends with God telling Job's friends to go back to Job and have him pray for them and restore them. But Job doesn't stop being friends with them. Job makes a covenant with them. You can't get rid of me. We made it. 24 chapters. Congratulations. Let's apply this. Friends. You're going to have friends? Friends will hurt you. Friends will hurt you. Listen to Matthew chapter 26. If you know me, you know me well enough. We're not really done. Matthew 26. It's what preachers say when they want to feel better about themselves. They're not going too long. Matthew 26, verse 31 to 34. Jesus, on the night that he's betrayed and about to be crucified, and he knows this, Jesus said to his disciples, you will all fall away because of me this night. For it's written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. And here it is. But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee. So then Peter, I love Peter. Peter's one of my favorites. Peter answered him, hey, though all those guys, though they'll all fall away because of you, I will never fall away. Jesus said to him, Peter, truly I tell you, this very night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And then Peter goes on even more, telling him, if I need to die with you, I'll die. The thing is, Peter denied him three times. Jesus understands being hurt by his friends. In fact, Jesus' friends were hurt by Jesus as well. But it was their expectations of Jesus. Why would you ever leave us? Why would you go? Friends don't leave. You know, friends stick around. Friends do this. Their expectations of their friendship with Jesus were hurt. But Jesus didn't hurt them. But Jesus was hurt by them. But here's the thing. Jesus promised a restoration. After I'm raised, I want you to meet me. So Peter denies Jesus. Jesus goes to the cross, dies, rises from the dead. Women come to the tomb. And what does Jesus say to the women? Go and tell Peter and the disciples that I'm alive and meet me in this place. So imagine the women rushing back there. Hey, Jesus is alive. They're like, no, he's not. Yes, he is. And Peter, Jesus really wants to see you. Ooh, you know, like everyone's like, what did Peter do? Maybe this wasn't public conversation that Jesus had with Peter. We don't know. But Peter denies Jesus three times. What a great friend, huh? But then Jesus has breakfast with Peter. And he says, Peter, do you love me? He says, you know I love you. And he tells him, tend my sheep. And he asks him again, Peter, do you love me? Same conversation. Jesus, you know I love you. Tend my lambs. And then he says, Peter, do you love me? And he says, Peter was annoyed. Same conversation three times. But that was intentional because Jesus is saying, you denied me three times, and I'm restoring you three times. Peter, you're my friend. Even though you denied me, I'm making a covenant with you that's so much beyond your denial of me in that moment. And I want to have you consider making covenants with your friends. I don't know what that looks like. Don't make it too weird. But have this idea, like, what are we actually covenanting with one another for? Like, when are we done? Marriages, they make covenants, and there's a whole list of the vows that they're making. Why don't we do the similar type thing in our friendships? So that we know, oh, you're not just going to bail on me when things get really difficult. We want covenant friends that look at one another and say, you can't get rid of me. You can't get rid of me. Let me tell you how to receive bad advice. When your friends do give you bad advice, one, don't end the friendship right away. Give them grace in that moment. Assume that they're doing their best, right? I've had friends give me very stupid advice before. I'm like, seriously? Like, no, yeah, that's what I think. Okay. They're not my friends anymore, but no. But that idea that we're going to give bad advice. And if we're friends, then we have lots of time later to have these conversations to work through those issues. And then if you've been hurt by your friends, well, speak to Jesus about it. Not only does he understand you, but he can heal you as well. The last thing I want to do is talk about how do we approach people who are suffering? Because your friends will suffer. Your friends will suffer. So how do we approach our friends that suffer? One, we pray. Don't assume that because your friend is suffering, they want you there immediately. My friends know I don't want them there immediately. Personally, I want to work through a few things first and understand what's going on. And so as your friend is suffering, pray, God, what can I do? How do I minister? Secondly, have a good theology. Your time to develop an understanding of suffering is not in the midst of suffering. It's now. Right? This is why we're doing this series, Summer of Loss. You're like, yeah, good times, Canada Day, summer. It's like, let's talk about suffering. Why? Because during the good times, that's when we learn how to suffer. So that when it comes, we're not surprised by it. We're like, oh, I knew you'd be here. You're never going to be fully ready for it. You're never like taking out your suffering military bag, like, oh yeah, what tools do I have with me? But the reality that we understand who God is and that we don't make decisions in the dark, right? We don't create theology in the dark. We can't see well. We do that in the light. And then we bring that stuff into the dark with us. Third, if your friend is suffering, be present with them. You can say things like, hey, I'm just going to be here. If you want to talk, if you want to pray, if you want me to do something for you, I'm just going to be here. And you can tell me when to leave, but I'm just going to be here. Be present with them. Don't assume what's been going on, right? Please don't assume things. Ask good questions. Now, you might be hearing this thinking, this is really common sense, Dwight. I know. But I've been doing this for about 12 years now after planting the church, and I'm finding out that common sense isn't uber common. Right? So ask good questions. When did this begin? What's been going on? What are you feeling? What do you want to do? Like, what does this make you feel like doing? Where's your hope? Ask good questions. Don't aim to solve. Sometimes I'm learning, but I still do this. Sometimes in my marriage, my wife Jess will tell me something, and immediately my mind goes into like solution, and I'm trying to like line that up perfectly, and she can tell now. She says, "Hey, you can relax. I'm not looking for you to solve my problem. I just want you to listen." I'm like, "Oh, okay." It's a huge resting point for me. But I always want to solve things. I just want to make them better. I want to get past it. But you don't have to solve your friend's problem. Don't jump on things said. I already said this a little bit. Words come out sideways when we're suffering. Just don't jump on them. Encourage them with God's presence and hope. Right? God is here with us. God is not displeased with you. God is not embarrassed by you. God sent his son Jesus to die in your place and suffer in that moment eternally so that you don't have to suffer eternally. One day the suffering is going to come to an end. Don't make false promises that you can't come through on. Don't say this suffering is going to end soon because you don't know that to be true. Don't lie to your friend. Go into a better place. We make up stuff when things get hard. But we can promise them that God's not going anywhere and he's not shy of this pain. He's here with you, going through it with you, and so am I. Thank them for involving you. Thank them for involving you, because that's a gift that someone would let you into their suffering. And then help practically. Sometimes when people are going through hard things, we say, "Hey, is there anything I can do for you?" Don't ask that way. Say, "I'm going to do something for you. I want to be helpful. Would it be better if I made a meal? If I watched your kids?" You're like, "I don't have any kids, but that would be great." Like, don't watch your kids if they don't have kids, all right? Would it be good if I sent you Uber Eats? Do you want to talk? Can I I'm going to help. How can I help? And then give them lots of ideas to choose from. Because in that moment, decision fatigue is strong. I'm not into like, "Well, you know, on Thursday I might want some chicken parm, but I do have a dairy thing, so make sure it's lactose." It's like, I'm not thinking about that. Like, I probably won't even eat. If you don't put food in front of me, I'm probably not going to eat in that moment. And then follow up. Follow up with them. Put a reminder in your calendar, right? You're like, "Oh, but that's not authentic." Yes, it is. It's authentically loving them to put a reminder in your calendar, follow up with them tomorrow, next week, whatever it is. How are things going? Do you need me for something else? How else can I serve you? And continue to pray for them. The ultimate things that friends do, though, is friends cling to Jesus together. We cling to Jesus together. Listen to this dialogue between Sam and Frodo. Make-believe characters still, right? Frodo says, "I can't do this, Sam." Sam says, "I know. It's all wrong. By rights, we shouldn't even be here, but we are. It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo, the ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were, and sometimes you didn't want to know the end. Because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad happened? But in the end, here it is, in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come, and when the sun shines, it will shine out the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you. That meant something. Even if you were too small to understand why, but I think, Mr. Frodo, I do understand. I know now." We need friends who are going to come to us in the shadow and remind us resurrection is coming. Jesus is coming back. I don't know how all this is going to work, but you can't get rid of me. Things are really tough. We can be like Sam when he says, "I know you can't do this, but I'm in it with you." Resurrection is coming, and friends, you get to speak to your friends. You get to speak hope into the "I can'ts" that your friends are saying in the midst of the suffering. And the best news of the day, best news you'll hear anywhere today, is that Jesus is our friend. Jesus is our friend, and he holds on to us. It's not the other way around where you feel like you're just clinging on to him for dear life. He's like, "Well, we'll see if your grip's strong enough." But he has you the whole time. When you feel like you're letting go, he's like, "Relax." It's like a child at the pool. We're at the pool all day long, you know, in the summer, swimming and swim classes and all that stuff. It's like the child that's learning to swim and they let go of the wall, and they think they're drowning, even though their swim instructor is completely holding them, and they have a little bubble on their back. But because they let go, they feel like everything's going down. And Jesus is saying, I've got you. I've got you. I'm your friend, and I'm not going anywhere. I'm your blood brother. I am the one who's made a covenant with you that I will never leave you or forsake you. So let me challenge you with this, and then we'll respond. Have you been hurt? Have you been hurt by a friend? Well, go to them. Go back to them. Work that through. Work toward reconciliation and restoration. Don't just hang out. This is, Jesus said, in terms of giving an offering, he said, hey, if you have an issue with your brother or sister, very familial language in the church. So not literal biological brother, but literal spiritual brother or sister. If you have an issue with them, go back and make that right. Go back and make that right first. If you've been hurt, go to them. Go to them. If you've hurt others, if you've hurt your friends, go to them. Go to them with the I'm sorries. Not I'm sorry that you did this, so I had to do this. Those are really fun sorries to get, right? Oh, so it's really still my fault. Go with the I'm owning this part. I want to make this right. Jesus has forgiven me everything. This is the gospel forgiveness. He's forgiven me everything. And so I want to come to you and ask for forgiveness. Suffering. If you have friends that are in suffering, don't be aloof and hope that it just goes away. You're equipped by the Spirit of God to go to them in their suffering. Jesus said that he would give us words for certain moments in life that we can't conjure up or figure out in that moment, but Jesus can give us words of comfort and consolation and life as we go to them in suffering. And then we covenant with them. We covenant with them that we're not going anywhere. So I'm going to pray, and then we'll respond to this. Jesus, thank you that you are our friend. Thank you that you love us. Thank you that you're not going anywhere. And thank you that your friendship actually redefines friendship for us, that we don't need to be fickle friends with people. We don't need to be fair-weather friends. We don't need to be friends that just stick around when things are really wonderful for us, but rather we can be friends who are there for people in their worst of times, because you come with us, Jesus. You bring wisdom, you bring healing, you bring life, you bring joy, you bring even happiness into deep sorrow. And I pray that we would be a people that don't shy away from those who are suffering, but rather we draw near, because you draw near to the brokenhearted, you draw near to the ones who are hurting, and you're pleased to call them your friends. You were pleased to die on the cross for them. You were pleased to come back to life and restore them. I want to pray for people who are here who only know you as their enemy, who have never seen you as their friends, who have never been forgiven, that this morning they would see that you, Jesus, went to the cross for them, died in their place, rose for them, so that they could be brought into the family of God. Not karma, but your grace, a gift, and that they would be received this morning, that they would know that they are loved. I want to pray for those of us who have hurt people, hurt our friends, that you would bring those people to mind and that we would go back to them today and begin to work through that. For those of us who have been hurt by our friends, that we would forgive, that we would not let bitterness take hold in our heart and create a callus around our heart, but that we would remain soft toward people. Help us to respond well this morning to the fact that you're here with us, Jesus, and you're not embarrassed by us. You're a friend. And you love us. It's the best news we'll hear all day. We need you. Amen.